Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
To boldly go where no man has gone before.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best in new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7pm here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
Hit the music. It's Saturday, it's just after 11, and you know what that means? It's time for the Live Science Radio Show.
Wow, what a totally amazing, excellent discovery.
It will test your head, and your mind, and your brain, too.
Come on, let's go, Space Trekker!
Yay, this is where you're supposed to clap, James. Yay! Woo! We want more, more, more. We haven't even started yet. Welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms. You've got Julian Paul live here as usual, hot from Soul Plus the hour before. We've got James still with us.
If he wants, he can talk about quantum physics.
He can, or some other interesting
enough,
thing.
That was just
your specialist subject.
Good.
So James is one of the welly wangers at Wentworth Woodhouse Preservation Trust in Rotherham, where we are also volunteers in the gardeners team, but we're called the Bramble Bashers, but for any of them listening.
James is also in the digital team.
Oh, you are, aren't you?
I'm part of the digital team, yeah.
And you're pretty much into photography as well.
Yeah, yeah, I love it, yeah.
Excellent. So this week and every second Saturday of the month, our guest phone is Dr. Ogo Osamor. We think he's talking about anaerobic digestion, but
that's
I'm not quite sure yet.
Are you up, Ogo?
We don't know. Next week, I'm afraid Gareth Morgan, our regular guest from the Sheffield Photographic Society, can't be with us. So we're just going to be looking for another guest speaker there. On that note, Sheffield Photographic Society's exhibition at Sheffield Cathedral finishes tomorrow. We went on Thursday. It's fantastic.
Very good, very good.
Very impressive. And actually, Sheffield Cathedral's great to have a look around as well.
Yes,
it's a free exhibition. There's loads of different prints in all sort of manner of subjects, really. Fantastic stuff. Later in the show, we'll be talking to RPG. And before that, Paul's going to talk about or remind us of a few things happening
and
around our local area.
Firstly, Festival of Debate, Tuesday 16th of April to Saturday 25th of May. This year's South Yorkshire Festival, mainly based in Sheffield, has been programmed to explore three core questions, including how can we respond to the climate crisis and biosphere collapse? And that's www.festivalofdebate.com. And then at the Dalham Gallery in Doncaster, Gresley, Genius of Steam and Speed. That's Tuesday, 23rd April to Saturday, 21st September, 2024. And Pint of Science Festival. That runs from Monday 13th to Wednesday the 15th of May. The world's largest festival of public science is set to return to Sheffield next month, with scientists from the University of Sheffield taking to the city's pubs and venues to share their scientific discoveries. Sheffield joins nearly 500 cities across 25 countries around the world, taking part in the 12th year of the Global Festival. Tickets on sale now.
So I just Googled Pint of Science Festival, Sheffield, and it'll come up with the links to all the different events. And they're in all sorts of pubs and venues around Sheffield, so just pick the one that's nearest to you. Next up...
It's a pub crawl, really.
Well, it is, but it's supposed to be educational, yes. Isn't it? But something else very interesting, like our surgery is taking part in a study. So Paul and I both got a text message asking if we wanted to take part. That's all good. Telling Izzy's going to be on air later on. It's called Discover Me. And if you want to find out information about it, if you go to www.discovermestudy.com, it's a nationwide research study that will analyse health and genetic information from thousands of people in order to improve the understanding of many different diseases and to find ways to help GP practices improve patient care. The study is being run by Omigen, which is a research and development company run by senior academics from the University of Cambridge, who are working closely in partnership with GPs and NHS research nurses. So if you participate in the study, you'll need to provide a DNA sample. And that might sound a bit scary, but actually it's either from a mouth swab or a saliva sample, so nothing too nasty there. And the genetic information from that DNA will then be analysed alongside your medical health record information. So together, this information will help health services to transform patient care in the future by being better able to predict individuals who are likely to develop diseases in the future, improve the accuracy of disease diagnosis, better understand how diseases progress and discover new treatments. So if you do participate in the study, you'll have the option of getting access to an online portal enabling you to view limited health and genetic information about yourself. Very interesting, but you don't have to do that bit of it. You can take part if you are aged 18 or over, you're able to consent to the study for yourself, and your GP practice or online patient service provider is participating in the study. Generally, if your GP practice is taking part, you'll have probably already had a message about it anyway. Another thing in the news this week, shorter prostate cancer scans will help many more men. This was in the press on the 7th of April, so probably last Sunday. Cutting the duration of MRI scans for prostate cancer by a third would make them cheaper and more accessible without reducing their accuracy. That is a key result of a UK trial which indicates that lowering costs could ensure more men are offered scans. According to Cancer Research UK, there are about 52,300 new prostate cancer cases every year in the UK, equal to more than 140 every day. At present, doctors offer patients with suspected prostate cancer a three-stage MRI scan with a patient injected with a contrast dye at the third stage, because that helps to enhance the images from the scan. It's part of the trial entitled PRIME and involving 555 patients from 22 hospitals in 12 countries. Researchers from University College London, or UCL, and the University College London hospitals assessed the impact of dropping the third stage scan. They found that using the shorter scan allowed specialists to diagnose 29% of prostate cancers, which is exactly the same proportion as if they used that third scan. So Dr. Claire Allen, who's the lead radiologist on the trial, said the results, which were presented at the European Association of Urology Conference in Paris last week, showed that significant prostate cancers were unlikely to be missed in the absence of a contrast scan, which is where they inject the dye into your bloodstream. The scans will be quicker, cheaper, and can be offered to more men, she said, although it's critical to emphasise that dropping the third part of the MRI scan is dependent on the first two parts of the scan being of very high quality. All good news, eh? And Paul?
And finally, well, not finally, a paperback that's called Meetings with Moths, Discovering Their Mystery and Extraordinary Lives by Katy Baird. When did you last meet a moth? Asked ecologist Katy Baird, setting the tone for a tale of nocturnal pursuit, light traps at the ready. She navigates subterranean caves, steep cliffs, even car park loos in search of nature's night shift pollinators. along with so many other insects, moths are in trouble, making this call to look more closely at the world around us all the more urgent.
So book for reading, eh? Meetings with moths. Next up, a bit of an environment update. A few things here. OS, data detection, new data enhancements provided by Ordnance Survey will help support biodiversity and landscape monitoring. The update includes the launch of new field boundary data, which details boundaries such as man-made walls, trees or hedgerows, as well as their height and width. This will help organisations assess changes to Britain's landscape over time and allow for the identification of wildlife corridors and pollinator networks. Next one, connecting Nigerian communities, a very interesting one. A renewable energy startup is providing solar microgrids to poor communities in rural Nigeria to fight energy poverty. Renewable Energy Environmental Sustainability was set up in 2017 by the 32-year-old entrepreneur Yetunde Fadeyi, who created the organisation after her friend was killed by carbon monoxide poisoning from a petrol-powered generator in her home. She has now provided solar energy to over 6,000 people in the poorest parts of Nigeria, transforming the lives of communities that previously had no access to electricity. London lions. A trio of Asiatic lion cubs have been born at London Zoo in a boost for conservation efforts. Born to 7-year-old mum Ira and 14-year-old dad Banu, the litter will form part of the Zoological Society of London's breeding programme for the endangered species. Only about 600 Asiatic lions remain in the wild, with their entire population confined to the Gir Forest in Gujarat in India. Finally, a disappearing iceberg A23A. Somewhere in the vast expanse of the southern Atlantic Ocean, the world's largest iceberg is disappearing. Not good news. The scale of A23, which broke free from the seabed in 2020, is moving towards South Georgia. It spans 3,800 square kilometres in area and has an average thickness of 280 metres, which is about the height of the Eiffel Tower. So get your head around that. Whilst the breakaway of the A23 iceberg is thought to be part of a natural calving process, much of Antarctica is now melting at an accelerated rate due to the effects of climate change. Great track there, Ice Age by Joy Division, can you believe? We'll be playing more of them on Glory Days Rock Show as well. Anyway, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms, we should have our PG on the line.
5, 4, 3... 3, 2, 1.
Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
What an introduction, eh?
Yeah, very good, eh?
It is, isn't it? Anyway, we've got James in the studio with us.
Say yeah, hello. I was going to say welcome to James.
Hey. Hi, good morning, PG.
Hi.
Yeah, he's getting used to it. It's all been a bit overwhelming for him.
Yes, yeah, as it is for us all.
So, what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Oh, not quite my eye.
Oh, I
was sitting wondering what I could talk about and sort of brushing my tongue across my teeth, as you do. And I thought, well, you know, we've talked about the sense of smell after COVID and lots of things like that and explain what was going on, but the tongue often gets left behind, I think, in a lot of respects. It's with us constantly, but we take a lot of it for granted. So I thought, well, okay, when the smell is our olfactory sense, but our sense of taste is gustation or taste perception. And if you look at your tongue, it's a very sort of muscular organ in your mouth. It's set up with four internal muscles which control the shape of the tongue. But then there are four external anchored muscles that dictate the position of your tongue. So it's simple but quite complex, if you like.
It's not something you often think about, is it?
No, I think it's one of those things, and it's one of the things I like to bring to the science show. I mean, we started the science show as something that the ordinary person in the street might sort of think about.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's one of those things until something happens.
Exactly.
You kind of get a highlight for what it particular do for you. But your taste is a sensation that really occurs in your mouth. And it's when a substance which reacts chemically with your taste receptor cells that are located in your taste buds or papillae, and they will actually be responding to things that taste. And one of the things that releases the taste is the saliva in your mouth to liquefies some of the things that we get. Because often tastes and when we taste down to pheromones, and you'll hear pheromones talked about in sexual attraction and things like that. So there are very fine particles that you pick up and can identify through taste receptors and through your olfactory system. And one of the things that you've got to consider with taste is how we understand it. I mean, we started out by identifying the different types of taste that you can identify. And so you get sort of the four tastes, sweet, sour, bitter, and goodness me, I can't read
sweet,
my own
sour. Like
salty. Yeah.
I like it, Paul.
But sneakily, these days, chefs have started to try and discover more about this fifth taste, which is called umami.
Umami, yeah.
Yeah, so and it's a sort of difficult to say. It's a savouring taste, I guess. It makes things more savourable. Sort of starts out, I guess, we used our tongue and our taste receptors to check if food was ripe. And human beings have got a bit of a natural inclination towards sweetness. And that really, I guess, comes from evolution, where the sweeter things gave us more energy. Sweeter fruits and sort of things. Honey, it has long been a staple for people around the world to collect. And it's got high energy content, which is a sort of sweet taste that is related to that sort of set of taste sensations. But quite often it's not realised that your olfactory system supplies information to your mouth through a connecting tube. So part of the thing about how you taste is actually tied up with how you smell.
Yeah, yeah.
So your nose is lined with receptors for sort of the smells, and information about the smell is fed into your gustation, your mouth sensations, to complement. So quite often, one of the things, again, if you look at the new world of cooking and the chefs, they have things that they call dark meals, where you led into a darkened room, you dimly lit at first so you can find your table and sit down, but then the lights go down and you're served your food in darkness. So you miss the visual part of looking to say, how would you check if a tomato is ripe? Well, you look for the redness, yeah? So that element disappears. So you sort of are battened down to your combination of smell and taste. And again, one of the things that used to, way back when you were a youngster and you had to have a huge spoonful of cod liver oil, showing my age a bit. But one of the things that you did was to hold your nose.
Yeah.
So you pinch your nose to take nasty medicine because it cut down on that sensation that comes with the combination of the smell to the taste. And quite often these days, they'll interfere with things. So, again, a lot of the modern chefs have got very playful about creating foods that look totally unlike food until you start to eat them. So, Heston Blumenthal sort of creates a lot of meals which something that looks like a boiled egg, but it's not a boiled egg, even though it's white, it looks egg-shaped, and it's got a runny yolk, or appears to have in the centre, but it's actually a sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a scientific background, didn't he? And yeah, he was saying, you know, you just touching on them points about that you eat with your eyes as well.
Yes, and I say that, so the sense of taste, and you say, well, okay, you know, we might be predisposed to sweetness, but how come, you know, some of us like Brussels sprouts and some don't? Or, you know, you take any food that you like, there's going to be pro and con people for those. And sometimes it may be that you've never actually encountered that food, or you don't think you've encountered that food. But some of the findings are that pregnant mothers can pass on some kind of knowledge via the amniotic fluid to an unborn baby. So the baby can be born to be a Brussels sprout hater without really having a clear idea of how that came about.
Interesting.
You kind of think this big pink thing that you stick out at yourself in the morning to see if you're still alive is there, and you know all about it. But in actual fact, there are so many links through to your taste buds, your sense of taste, but also your perceptions.
Yeah. And, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's the kind of thing that, as I say, it's worth sort of sitting and thinking, well, what do you actually use your tongue and your mouth a lot as a youngster to explore the world. So what do you do when you pick things up? Shove it in your mouth. And if it's sharp, you take it out again quickly. Yeah, but it could be, oh, it tastes nice. If it's a lollipop, you think, oh, that's great. Or it could be a sprout and you go,
You don't like it. Interesting about tongue as well. It's integral to speech as well.
Absolutely, and you know, simple things. It's also rudimentary your tooth cleaner. So if you think after a good meal, how often do you sit there brushing your tongue across your teeth and finding those little morsels that still remain. And it sort of got that kind of a role as well. But equally, say you've got four internal unanchored muscles that change the shape of your tongue, and that's the basis of controlling sound making for speech.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so you kind of have got a lot of things going on, and say it's one of those that we take so much for granted. It's roughly kind of divided into two along the length, and there's a central groove that is apparent on your tongue. I say there are four anchor points which come down to a sort of triangle shape in your neck area, and they control where you position your tongue in your mouth. But if you can, one of those lucky people who can curl their tongue or, you know,
touch your nose.
Things. Yeah, all of that. But, you know, things like whistle. Can you whistle? Your tongue has a role to play in guiding the air through your mouth when you whistle. So a lot of things that we do on a regular basis that are all derived from how the tongue is created. And it's kind of a common thing on four-limbed animals to have a kind of layout with the tongue. And say things like a snake, a reptile, actually uses its tongue to taste the air, which is a replacement really for smell. So a lot of the time they'll be able to find their prey by picking up their smell in some way, you know. And smell gets lots of different connotations. We have an odour, which is kind of maybe not a sweet smell. It's something different. Pheromones are very difficult to sort of tie down, but they're kind of an almost invisible signal that's carried in a smell. And you can see that different sort of ways that you do things with your mouth. There's a kind of a taste that if you taste a piece of iron in your mouth and then taste some blood, you find it rings a bell.
Yeah.
There's so much iron in your blood.
Hopefully.
Yeah. it triggers a similar sensation, and then it's a matter of taste by degrees as to how the reality of what it is. But it's an interesting area, I think, and one that's not far from your brain, so maybe it's worth a bit of thought.
I'm going to say there's going to be loads of people now looking in their tongue and removing it round, sticking it out, trying to touch your nose. Fascinating. Fantastic stuff, Paul.
Hours of fun.
Indeed. You need to get out more, Paul.
I think so, yeah.
I know. Brilliant, Paul. Great stuff. All being well, we'll speak to you at Monday, Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3.
Look forward to it. Cheers, guys.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Paul.
Bye.
All the time, out of school, and the dead of now. All those faces come back to me. I'll be begging to swim the sea. Yeah, babe, a picture story. Make you cry in all your glory. I need to quench the thirst of many.
With Taste It, because nice our PG track was talking about tongs and all that sort of thing. Anyway, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org playing, talking about science.
You've lost it.
I have. Talking about science in all its different forms. We should have Dr. Ogo Osamo on the line. Good morning, Ogo, sir.
Good morning, Julie. How are you doing?
Very well. Great to have you on the show again, Ogo.
Thank you very much.
So we've got a guest in the studio today as well. So we've got Julie Paul, but we've also got James as well.
What?
Good morning, okay. Ogo.
Yeah, great stuff.
Good morning,
stuff.
Good morning.
Good How morning. You guys doing? We're doing very, very well. We've had an interesting morning, Ogo. Now, for people who don't know who you are, before you retired, we used to work together in the air quality team for Sheffield City Council.
That's correct.
So your background is chemistry.
Yep.
And you come correct. And talk about all sorts of things to us. And we do sometimes give you some hard tasks, Ogo, don't we, to be fair? You have to work hard. So today you're going to be talking about anaerobic digestion.
Funny, because Paul's been talking about the tongue, and now we're going a bit further down.
Yeah, but what is anaerobic digestion, you may ask?
Right. In effect, it's a sequence of processes by which microorganisms break down biodegradable materials in the absence of oxygen. So there's no oxygen.
Ah, is that the key thing then?
That is the key thing. And the process is also used in industry, but people also can do it domestically in your backyard and so on. Now, if you think about a cow, what goes through in its stomach?
Oh, yes.
And the products of that?
Yes.
Biogas? Right. Same as us human beings as well.
Oh, okay. Oh, because there's no oxygen in there.
There's no oxygen there. And you may remember some comedians in the past would strike a match and you get a fire. Boom.
Oh! You've cracked Paul up now.
Yeah,
Ogo.
There was some famous.
Well, anybody listening, please do not try this at home.
Oh yes, please. Thank you for that.
What shows have you been watching, Ogo?
They're all diagrammatic, actually. Essentially, bacteria in the gut, bacteria in these digesters, as work on biomaterials. For example, you can have manure, you know, from animal dung. You can have, you know, food waste, grease, you know, from cooking fat and so forth.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Put into these digesters. But what's crucial is that you exclude oxygen and there are bacterial activity going on. Industrially, they actually try and maintain it at a given temperature between 60, 70, 80 degrees, you know, between 60, around about 60, 70 degrees. And then it's allowed to churn, you know, through the digester. Then the bacteria then breaks down the organic mass, and what it releases often is what's called biogas, but also there are what's called digestates, basically what's been broken down. And the products then become liquid manure as well as solid manure. Then the biogas itself mainly contains methane. Up to 75% of the gas is methane. It contains carbon dioxide. It also contains nitrogen and some small amounts of hydrogen. So when we talk about biogas, then you can clean that up and use it for transport. The methane can be used for transport or heating.
Oh, right. So, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can see that the anaerobic digestion process actually falls into the renewable energy, you know, process as well, or system.
I was going to ask you, why would you want to do it as an industrial process? Right. But you're taking, yeah. I presume you're taking waste products.
That's right, food waste and, you know, bio waste, basically.
So could you actually do it from human sewage then?
Yes, you can.
Wow.
But what happens though with that? Again, the condition is no oxygen.
Yeah.
So you can do it from, you know, human waste. If you remember when we were working, I don't know if you, I'm sure you remember it. We had, there was a time we tested out, you know, the council tested out methane as a gas for vehicle, for transport systems.
Was this for Veolia? Was it for the refuse vehicles? You know, the bin lorries?
No, it wasn't. It was just, you know, testing out methane as a gas. And one of the things we did was went down Bawtry Road. There used to be a waste recycling place beyond where I think it's oxygen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
VOC.
Yeah, O2.
Yeah.
And we collected gas, you know, methane gas that was produced through bio-waste, you know. Now, the important thing is that in anaerobic digestion, you use organic material from waste. You exclude oxygen, you allow the bacteria to do its job. And once it's done its job, the products are also very valuable. As I've already spoken about methane, or biogas really, which you can clean up into methane and use it for heating or use it for transport. Then there's the digestate, which is composed of liquid digestate as well as solid digestate. And again, that can go back into your farmlands. In fact, it's the most effective and efficient way.
Is it?
Yeah. It's quality organic material. Now, in terms of carbon footprint, you generally have a negative carbon footprint because the waste you put into the digestate helps you produce the manure that allows you to grow organic material again. So
so it's sustainable. It's renewable.
It's very sustainable. Yeah, it's renewable. And the reason it's renewable is that the source of that energy, in terms of waste, is renewable. So it's a brilliant and a fantastic way of managing waste.
And do we do it in Sheffield?
Not that I'm aware of. There was some effort to try and construct one near Hillsborough Way.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't know whether that's now been commissioned or whether it's been developed any further. But there are parts of, I think, around about Nottingham area, there are digesters that are, you know, functioning.
I presume it's to set the process up is a complicated bit.
Yeah, because again, it's the economics of it. You know, people want to make sure that
they're going to make money out of it. It's not going to cost them more to do it than. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing, is the economics of it. If it works out economically, then it's a great way of managing waste, because you manage all sorts of waste. Animal waste, organic waste as well.
Yeah. You know, when you talked about grease being used in the same way, is that the things that some McDonald's and people do, where they take all the leftover oil and they turn it into fuel?
There are two things. There are two ways that works. I'm not exactly sure what, you know, McDonald's do, but if they... Because what some people do... They take that waste. If you remember in Attercliffe anyway, there used to be a company that would take such waste, clean it up chemically, and then you end up with a biofuel. Now, that biofuel is it's fuel that's been processed a little bit to reduce its carbon impact.
It's not a fossil fuel, is it? It's you're getting that fuel from a sustainable source.
Yes, it's not fossil fuel. You're actually using grease to produce that type of fuel. But what there's no, it's not a biological breakdown. It's a chemical process. It's a little bit of esterification, really.
That's a big word. I sort of remember that from chemistry, Ogo.
Right.
An ester.
Yeah. So that's what they try and create a little bit. About, 5% of it is of the oil is converted, or it's cleaned, but it's produces.
So the difference is grease to biofuel is a chemical reaction, cleaning, but whereas the anaerobic one is a bacterial natural process.
They're both biofuels, but one is done chemically and the other is biological.
Yeah. Mm. So you know when you get that product, obviously the product, if you get liquid manure or solid manure, that goes back onto the land. But you know if you want to use the gas, then the biogas, can any vehicle use that? It has to be set up specifically.
Yes, we tested it here in Sheffield.
Yeah.
Any vehicle can use that. Once it's cleaned up correctly, in other words, you remove the carbon dioxide component, you remove, the other organic, high boiling organic components and so on, then you end up with methane, because it's the same methane that we use in cooking, in our homes and stuff. But the way it's produced is different.
It's different. Mm.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Food for thought then.
So why isn't there, do you know, any idea why there's not more of these plants then, these anaerobic digestion plants? Just economics?
Not just economics, it's also policy. It depends on the commitments. In Sweden, in many parts of Europe, they actually use methane produced through anaerobic digestion to drive their trains and stuff like that. So it's
a policy thing, as often these things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I remember, Ogo, when we worked together, you said anaerobic digestion was a fantastic thing, and so was hydrogen.
Yes.
As a fuel.
Fuels, yes, because hydrogen definitely. As you know, ITM Power produces the methods by which can, you know, conduct hydrolysis of water to produce hydrogen.
Yeah, and they're all renewable and sustainable. But as with this anaerobic process, I guess it's policy, and B, it's getting the uptake as well, isn't it, and rolled out across cities.
But that's the power of policy. If government is supportive, then they will create that conducive environment and support businesses to invest in that, in those types of technology.
Yeah.
So countries and places where, you know, governments have committed, you know, to supporting these processes, you end up with
different outcomes. Indeed. Fascinating stuff. As always, Ogle, thank you very much for giving us your time.
Thank you. Yep, I hope it wasn't confusing.
No. And all being well, we'll speak to you next month.
Brilliant, yeah.
Okay, take care, Ogle.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. Bye-bye. Bye.
Yes,
bye-bye.
Bye.
Come down from the wire, and everybody wants them to a different biome. Sometimes we get burned, you think sometimes we learn. The one you love is the one that you take it higher. You ain't got no one, you better go back out and find them.
Guns N' Roses there with a track called Breakdown, because Ogo was talking about anaerobic digestion. Amazing stuff, eh? We are fast coming to the end of this week's edition of the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms. The film show are in the house. We've got Denise and Maymay. I'm in the house, ready to take over from 12 o'clock. And if you can hear that strange noise in the background, don't worry about it. Anyway, something I saw in the press of the week and I thought it was pretty interesting. It said greenery is the key to a good night's kip. So this report said living on a tree-lined street or with a view of the sea really does help you sleep, new research has found. A study of 16,000 people shows that 22% of those in built-up areas without access to greenery or water got less than 6 hours sleep a night, compared with 17% in so-called green or blue areas. So the researchers, led by Exeter University, said the impact of nature on sleep was roughly equivalent to whether someone was worrying about money, because that often keeps people awake, as does other things. Anyway, the scientists whose findings are published in Environmental Research said even looking out of the window at trees improves mental health. Visiting a park or walking in countryside has a similar effect. So Leanne Martin, the study's leader, said people who lived in greener streets reported better mental health, which was the driving factor behind getting a better night's sleep. So big link there between mental health and sleep. The team gathered their data on sleep in 18 countries, including the UK, parts of Europe, Australia, Canada and the US and Hong Kong. They adjusted their findings to population density to ensure the results were not skewed by noisy streets. The researchers said, Leanne Martin, the study's leader, said, in general, people reported being happier in themselves, in their lives, and that was leading to better sleep. The co-author, Matthew White of Vienna University, said, we think this demonstrates greenness should be recognised by governments as an important public health issue. Previous research also suggests that houseplants can also help improve sleep. Well, who knew? bit of King Crimson there with Sleepless. What a great track. We're talking about the importance of greenery to your sleep and indeed to your mental health. That's it for the Life Science Radio Show this week. Catch us next Saturday. If you can't wait until then, join us for Glory Days Rock Show, Mondays 1 till 3. And the film show is definitely in the house now, raring to go. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wake from your sleep, the drying of your tears. Today we escape, we escape. Pack and get dressed before your father hears us, before oh hell breaks loose. Sing us a song.